So how's it hanging for everyone?
I've been good. Good, good. Trying to figure out. Did you guys see that email that went out that confirmed that all the summer classes are online?
Well, that's not fun.
Yeah, I just got that, so
What did you
that's
say?
not surprising. An email went out like a few minutes ago, maybe 20 minutes ago, that confirmed that all of the summer classes will be online classes as well.
Awesome. Thanks for confirming.
Yeah. Except, I guess, the summer B right now, they're going to try and do in person. That one starts on July 9th, and then I think they'll change that if they need to. Okay, cool. Yeah. I think all the CSI summer classes are full term anyway. Don't know. I wonder who's teaching. God, I wonder who's teaching Calc 2 this summer. I highly recommend Andrew Dodds for any of your math classes. I think he's great.
Who's that?
Dodds. Oh, he did leave.
Oh, shit.
Sorry, guys. hold on a sec. Apparently, Mercari is also like a really good one. Oh, people really like Corey, so
Definitely Corey. Definitely Corey.
yeah, so that's where I think I would go for that. Okay, let's see. I think we can get started. I don't know. I know some of you actually have started a little bit of Attack Lab stuff, and we've had some questions. So I'm gonna kind of run through. Matt ran through the handout a little bit at the beginning of class, and I think it was helpful. So I'm gonna do that as well, just to like clarify some stuff. I think I'm gonna share. Can I just share my home? Okay. Okay, so again, we are, if we look at our handout, we are going to be looking at this binary through GDB and trying to format input to use with this program that will have it do things that it's not supposed to do, and then we'll have it do things that we want it to do. So everybody has at this point the info needed to get at least phase one done. Like phase one should be easy. Phase one's like a warm up. I just want to remind you guys that this is due on the 20th, which I think is, and it's in 5 days. Is that Monday?
Yep.
So it's coming up. So if you haven't started this, do it today or tomorrow. Just for so you have an idea of how long this will take. I think most people, if they were going to use it Grace Day, used it on Shell Lab. You shouldn't need one for this. And then as soon as we finish with this lab, I think we're going to be able to start talking to you about some stuff with the final, because we will be about done. We'll go over some stuff with pointers, and that we normally have to rush, and I think for once we don't have to rush it, which is great because pointers are like a cause of, I think, consternation for a lot of people with this class. And then we will kind of be, like I said, be done with that typical instruction that you get in this class. So we have some ideas for final stuff. We just have to finalize it. But we'll be able to talk about that after Attack Lab. Okay, so let's look at, you should have hopefully already all downloaded, everything you need from Autolab. You have to do this via SSH. You have to do it on either Systems Lab or Guacamole, which is Systems Lab. You have to do it either via SSH or via the web app. And you are going to have to turn in, you can turn in either a text file for each phase, or you can put them all in one text file at the end. But your score is not going to show up on the Autolab scoreboard until you input your solution with some comments. And it doesn't have to be like meaningful comments right now, but Autolab can't discern that anyway, obviously. But you might as well just comment as you go. I don't know if you figured out, but that's easier. Then your score will get updated. So make sure that you're doing that so you can see that Autolab scoreboard is working for you. I've had students in the past that have thought that they figured out a solution, but they did it in a way that wasn't quite legal. So they were like, the scoreboard's not working. And we had to be like, well, it's because you're not doing it this explicit way. You're trying to like bypass even the stuff that we're letting you bypass, which is great, but also like just not what we're looking for right now. So for the first three phases, we're looking at C target. And I think I'm not going to talk about our target today because we haven't done any return-oriented programming yet. And that'll be, I think, next lecture. We'll go on, then I'll go over like the second part of the lab as well. So we're looking at C target here. And if you look at this little getsBuff function here, it uses this vulnerable gets method. It has a character buffer of some size that is a variable that you don't know. That's something that you have to figure out with the size of your buffer. That's going to vary between different students' targets. So that's like one of your first challenges, right? Is figuring out what the size of the buffer is. That shouldn't be too difficult. We've talked a lot about like how the buffer gets and the stack gets set up. At the beginning of a function. And then your next couple of steps are going to get your program to call touch one, which that doesn't happen any, touch one is not called anywhere in the program. It exists as a function somewhere in a certain address, which you'll be able to figure out by looking at things like the disassembly, your OBJ dump. And actually, like, I think it's helpful. I think maybe I told you guys to do this during Bomb Lab too, but it's helpful to have your disassembly, like your OBJ dump file on a different terminal. So you can like look at that at the same time as like going through the actual lab stuff. So let's see. Oops. That is not what I meant to do. Okay. So phase one should be really simple. That is, if you remember in class the other day how we did that program, that little like, we did, there's two different programs. So there's that little password program that we looked at where you could override the password validation by overriding the buffer. And we also looked at via the slides what would happen if you fill up the buffer with something. It doesn't really matter what for the purposes of this phase and where that goes next. So if you, let me just pull up the slide so that I can help. So you know where to look for them. Let's see. Okay, so this is what I'm talking about. If we have this little demo program here, remember that all it does is like get a string and then put that string back out into standard output. We saw that the buffer size was 4 in the case of this. Like I said, that's the thing you have to figure out for your program. And then you are looking at the stack frame right now. So you've got your buffer, you've got some amount of like other space there that you would need to bypass in order to get to that return address, right? Because as we talked about, the only way that that a program knows where to return to once it like transfers control to some other procedure is from that stored on the stack return address. Like that's going to take you to that like next instruction after you called some function. Does anyone have questions about that? Because that's really important. So in this example, we have in our buffer, we have 0, 1, 2, 3 that we put in there. And then we've got a bunch of other junk. In this case, it's just other numbers. And because it was passed in as a string, it has this null terminator, this double zero at the end. And then just beyond that, you have the return address. So what you want to do for the first phase is figure out like how big your buffer is, how to overwrite that without getting a segmentation fault, right? Because if you go too far, if you give it an address that doesn't make sense to the system when it tries to slide, or I wish it would just like let me share wherever my screen was. Let me move back to the handout. Hold on. Okay, it is the handout. Okay, cool. It is doing what I wished it would do. okay, cool. So, okay. So you need to, like I, sorry, Zoom is great sometimes, but it's also so annoying in other ways. Not even talking about security things. So what you have to do is basically, and you can look at that diagram if it helps you, if it helps you to like draw out your stack and figure out like how big it is and how much you need to input to like start overwriting things. And then you should be using GDB to like walk through this and look at your stack in real time to try and like verify that what you're trying to do has actually happened. So what you're gonna wanna do is tell it to return to whenever it's ready to transfer control back, wherever you want it to return to, which in this case is touch one. So you have to find the address of touch one. You've gotta figure out how to overflow the buffer and put that in the right spot. And that is as complex as phase one gets. It's really pretty simple. Phase two and three are not much harder. The only way that that's going to differ is you are going to have to figure out how to get this like cookie, and everybody's cookie is different. So that's another thing about everybody's program that's gonna be different, but you need to call touch two or touch three. And touch two, you just need to pass in the cookie, and touch three, I think you need to pass it in as a string. You need to do that before you try and call touch two, right? Because when you call touch two, it will pass in like whatever you already have set up. And remember, this is like where this is where everything kind of ties together. And it might not be like obvious just from like these different pieces of things that we've told you, but remember, when you call a function, if there are like, if it is looking for parameters to be passed in, what's that first register that it's going to look for?
Are you asking a question?
Yes. I mean, maybe somebody knows.
Yeah, or something.
Yeah, so it's going to look at RDI. So you want to figure out some way to take this cookie and place in RDI so that when you call touch two, it's going to be there. And you're going to do this by putting executable code. The first phase, you can just put junk in your buffer. It doesn't matter. The second and third phase, you're going to have to put some amount of like executable code in there. And you're going to do that like as bytecode, as machine instructions, basically. So we give you this little table. Of helpful dictionary of things you can use. So here are move instructions with different sources and different destinations. So this is like the kind of thing that you need to figure out how to get your cookie into a place where when you call touch two or touch three, it is being used and it's in the correct format. That's the hard stuff about those second two phases. And those two phases are also not too bad. So they are more complex. They're going to take you more time. And it's going to take a while for you to figure out how to use this bytecode, how to write things correctly, because little Indian can get confusing, how to like format things as strings. All of this stuff is stuff that you have to figure out. And also you're going to be creating these like answer text files. But in order to be able to use these files, you have to use this program that we've given you, this hex to raw program, to put it into a form that you can use as like an exploit. So this is how you do that. And then once you create this like raw file with your exploits, you can use that in GDB, like right here. You could also use it from the command line, right, like this, to just test to see if it works. And then if it's not working, you can run it through GDB and figure out why. So this is all in your handout. If you haven't read the handout yet, please at least read. So this like stuff that even after like the descriptions for phase 4 and 5 is important for phases 1 through 3. If I were you before class on Friday, I would try, it's not Friday, right? It's Wednesday. I would try to do phases 1 through 3. Because phases 4 and 5 are, I think, meaningfully harder. And if you can get 1 through 3 done, you're in a good spot. And you're also in a place where you kind of know what's going on. And you might have questions to ask, because we've got help hours tomorrow and then we have nothing until Tuesday. So you're kind of at the mercy of us responding via email, which we try to do. But, you know, we also have stuff going on and other things. And so I think it would be behoove of you to just go ahead and get started on this and have questions to ask. We can definitely go through questions, and I hope we have some to go through on Friday. So go ahead and like read through this, give it a shot. We have help hours tomorrow. So if you want help, come there. We'll also be able to talk about stuff in Friday on class. On Friday in class, you know. Any questions so far? Any questions on Attack Lab stuff? David or Saroj, do you think I missed anything that is important to like let them know before they start trying to submit things? I feel like the important thing was that you have to submit something to AutoLab for the scoreboard to update, but.
Okay, cool. I do have a question.
Okay.
What is the exact line of code that you type into SSH to submit your stuff again?
You mean to submit via command line?
Yeah, the submit via command line thing.
David, will you take that question?
That's kind of hard to explain over Zoom like this, but it's like AutoLab submit course name, lab name, and then the file name. It tab completion works with it a little bit, and you have to have set it up in advance. Have you done it before?
Yeah.
I think we did set yours up, yeah.
Yeah, it was AutoLab submit, and then try some tab completion stuff and see if you can get it to, like, make some suggestions for you.
Hey, if you
Yeah, we can throw that up in Slack so that people who don't have that set up don't have to worry about it. But
you can just, like, type in AutoLab in your command line, and it'll give you, like, some information on like how to access the help documents, and then like from the help documents you literally can just see everything you need. So I would suggest doing that.
Yeah, good call.
That's what I do when I want to submit. The only thing is, like, I haven't been able to submit via the shell after the second lab. I tried every subsequent lab, but was unable to because it just wasn't available.
Yeah, and Matt is saying that guacamole isn't that bad for submitting stuff, and I would believe that. I think it gets really bad when we're all trying to use it at once, but I think if you're just using it to submit, it's probably not a huge issue. So if you don't have command line stuff set up, don't worry about it. It would be a nightmare to try and set up remotely, I feel like. So let's just not. If you already have it done, we'll try and get that in Slack or something so you can access that. Okay.
But the only other thing I wanted to maybe mention, and I don't know if you already covered this, I might have missed that, but does everybody have a good understanding of what hex-to-raw is and why we have to use that?
I did not cover that, so please feel free to talk about that a little.
Okay, just a quick overview would be you're going to need to input values into your programs that like are not going to be bytes that are ASCII encoded that you can type in from your keyboard. So hex-to-raw converts ASCII into actual raw bytes. So for example, you wouldn't be able to like type a memory address in if it contains like 0-4, for instance, because there's no key you can press on your keyboard that will send 0-4 to the program.
Cool. Okay. I am going to... Okay, so just to review, this is kind of where we left off. This is that diagram again. I think that these slides are really helpful to look at when you're working through this stuff so you have like a good depiction of the stack and what could be going on. Here's that illustration of like what happens when you overwrite the buffer with a string, and that that null terminator there like overwrites a little part of the address. Let's see. We talked a little bit about this too, and that's going to be like what we talked about for phases 2 and 3. So in this case, we've got our buffer and we have some executable code, and we are able to like have our direct our return address to the place in the buffer where that code starts, run that code, and then have it return like somewhere else, right? So this also, I think, is like a handy like diagram to look at. Okay, cool. And I think that maybe won't come into play until 4 and 5, but that's good to have in mind. Okay, we talked a little bit about this Morris worm. I'm not gonna say anything else about that. It's, you know, historical and important. I think that there are a few other buffer overflow attacks that are kind of interesting. So I don't know if anybody who's taking this class was born in the 80s or the, you know, early to mid 80s at least. If so, you're probably like very familiar with instant messaging. Instant messaging was what was up before everybody had cell phones. I like lived on instant messenger as a middle schooler, which is honestly, now that I know how the world works, more like pretty horrifying. But AOL was like the first company to create this program. AOL was really like how you got internet back in the day for a lot of people. They're kind of defunct now, as far as I know. They don't do a whole lot, but maybe I'm wrong about that. This is really insulting to AOL, but whatever. So they invented this instant messaging service where you could basically text people that were like your contacts via your computer. And you could also join like group chats and different kind of like chat rooms. And that's where that stuff kind of started becoming popular. So, at some point after that, Microsoft launched this MSN messaging service, and with MSN, you could use their messenger, and you could also access like AOL's instant messaging, like servers. And I think there were maybe a couple of other smaller ones that you could also access through MSN Messenger. So at some point, AOL wanted to have like this exclusive usage of their like servers and their chats and stuff. And they didn't want like MSN to be able to compete with them in that AIM was so popular that like allowing MSN to also utilize it was like a real boost to their service. So they were able to, Yahoo was the other one. That's what it was. Yahoo had their own messenger too. So AOL was able to do this thing. They were able to basically exploit a security flaw in their own code via buffer overflow, where they could kind of peek out of their program and look at what was running it, whether it was their AOL code or whether it was like not. And if it was not, they were able to like shut it down and make it inaccessible to like, you know, Yahoo or MSN. So this thing would happen where, you know, Microsoft Messenger would all of a sudden like not be able to access AOL servers, and then they would patch it and it would be fixed for a little while, and then it would happen again, and you know, so on and so forth. But that is what they were doing. They were exploiting this buffer overflow bug in their own code, and check and see like who was running that code. And it was discovered via this this email that was sent. So they were, I mean, this is, I don't remember the context for this. I think it was, this is very likely an AOL who said that AOL was basically making their program, their software incompatible with other software on purpose to stay more competitive. I think that's an interesting one. Okay, yeah, so there we are. Literally slides later, things are often for me. So that came from within Microsoft, you know, so that they were then able to publish it and basically throw AOL under the bus without any liability. Okay, so there's other stuff that's maybe like more meaningful to you guys. There was this in the Zelda game where you were able to choose a custom name for the horse, and if you chose this, you know, some special name that had some exploit code in it that would then get run, it would allow you to do other things. You think about that there. You also might be like familiar with jailbreaking phones. So Apple will restrict your ability to buy any app from anywhere that isn't the iTunes store, ostensibly for your own protection, to keep, you know, malicious apps from existing on your phone. They also, when iPhone first came out, you're only able to get iPhone via AT&T. So they also like locked their device to, you know, a certain carrier, and people kind of immediately utilized some overflow stuff to jailbreak their phone and be able to you know, use them on other carriers, put their own apps on them, run their own programs. So yeah, I don't know if anybody has done this. I have a lot of friends who have done this. I haven't, because I just don't care that much.
This has been a very nostalgic experience. Thank you.
I agree. Like, when I talk about AIM, I like get misty.
For sure.
It was a very, very meaningful part of my like formative years, was being able to, like, just a heads up, this is like I know this is like old people brag, but like, when I was 13, the thing that I asked for my birthday was my own phone line. Like, that was all I wanted. Like, the freedom that like having your own phone line and being able to talk to your friends without like your family interfering and being able to message them on the computer was bananas. And it makes me very, very nostalgic. So yeah, so that I think is some stuff that you guys might be familiar with. Let us get into a bit about, some defenses that help us avoid bullies, or obvious one is that the program we're using, you know, functions that have known vulnerabilities, and then there are safer functions now that do the same thing. So instead of GETs, we should be using FGETs. Instead of strcpy, we now have sterncpy. There's also something where with scan at F, you should be really careful about using the like the percent S string conversion specification. You can use FGETs to read the string, or if you are want to use scanf, you should use percent NS and then N, you know, that lets the program know a suitable size for that string so that overflow isn't happening. And we talked a little bit about this stuff and like why this stuff even exists in code, and there are several answers for that. It's harder to program things that are secure, obviously. And even if you were able to go through and not use any of this stuff, there's still going to be some vulnerabilities there. But this is important. Like if you're ever programming C, you should not be using these vulnerable. This is like the base level of things that you can do to avoid these overflow vulnerabilities. And I think maybe I mentioned this last class and didn't reiterate it at the end of that little slide set, but these vulnerabilities are still huge. They are like the number one technical vulnerability that's still exploited to this day. So there's a lot of it out there. It still happens all the time. It's really important to try and minimize this stuff. So that's from a programmer's perspective. We also have
scanf with S conversion.
Mm-hmm. Like the you know, the size of the string that it was allowed to, or this the number of characters that would basically port before stopping.
And it's just on the examples that we
convert,
like slowly. Even like string copy seem like really I guess all of these functions seem really popular.
Yeah,
like
they're pretty ubiquitous.
Okay, so this is really helpful to know.
And yeah, I mean, you're seeing them a lot too because some of the programs that we're giving you are purposefully vulnerable. But hopefully, in like real world scenarios, you're not gonna see this getting written into like a lot of new code, you know. These are obsolete vulnerable functions that shouldn't be used. They sometimes are still, and even if they aren't being written into new things, they're still existing in some older stuff. So they're on the same. And because this is like hard to deal with on a program level or you know, hard to deal with like for older programs, especially, we have some other like systems level stuff that we can do. So one thing is this randomized stack offset. So this stack randomization means that every time a program runs, it allocates some random amount of space in the stack. So basically what this is going to do is make it so it's really, really difficult for the attacker to predict where the beginning of any code that they insert is going to be located. You'll also see this referred to as ASLR, which is, I think, address stack layout randomization. So what this does is that it makes the addresses on the stack sufficiently random so that even if an attacker was able to inject, figuring out where to return to execute that code will be really, really difficult for this randomization.
What's doing that? Is that like a kernel or the OS that's doing that, or is that?
That's a good question. I would think that would be a kernel function.
Like, does the programmer have to specify that in their code, or does it like?
No. So some of this stuff some of this stuff happens automatically, and actually some of this stuff we have had to turn off so that it doesn't happen in these programs that you're playing with.
Oh, I see.
So a lot of this stuff is just by default at this point because it's so much more secure. This one and having the one I think we talk about next, which has to do with executable stack code. Okay, cool. So this is, a little diagram of that. It makes it hard for you to, figure out where to send the instruction pointer to start running code in your stack.
Looking at this diagram here, these segments at the bottom, like what are they? Can you elaborate?
Yeah, so this is just buffer, really, that somebody has written exploit code into, but there's some like buffer padding, and then this address is B ? In white is meant to be like the address of your exploitable code that you would return to. So the random stuff happens like further up in this, like towards the base of the stack, even before like stuff like gets run. So it just means that these addresses will be different every time. So if you look, here's an example of 5 executions of whatever program this is running. And they're all different. And if you didn't have this, they would, ostensibly like what we're looking at in Attack Lab always be the same.
Okay. The injection, the exploit code gets injected into like the text segment of memory.
It gets injected it's still in the buffer. So this is all just the stack still is maybe like,
okay.
Or actually, it is showing it below, maybe in this example, because it's showing it below application code, that maybe you're correct.
Okay, I'll think about this later. Sorry, I'm just...
No, no worries. I assumed that was the case, but I don't know why they put application code here, because that threw me off a little bit too. Okay, so the next one that we'll talk about, the next system level protection is, and I started to touch on this, is having a non-executable stack. So if you remember, we were on the last slide sections, different sections of memory have different permissions. So some are readable, some are writable, some are both, some are executable. So this executable bit was added, in the not system to keep things like having code in your stack from being executable. So in this instance, you would return to some like exploit code, even if you were able to figure out the address. Like if you didn't have that stack randomization, you'd return to this exploit code that was in your stack, but it would not be marked as executable. So nothing would happen. It would just fail, right? So that's another thing that is standard point is there's non-executable stacks. So before this was also now changed after we added that bit. Let's know whether or not we have like explicit to execute something. The last one that we'll talk about are stack canaries, and these come from this concept that miners, coal miners, used to bring canaries down with them because canaries are like very sensitive to, you know, death by gas, poisonous gas, probably death in general. So they would know that they were in the mine and the canary had died, that something was up and they should get out of there. So the idea, this idea that we implement in the stack is that we will have some special canary value that we'll place somewhere on our stack, like just beyond the buffer. And this value can be really should be different every time the program runs so that it's also not predictable. And the idea here is that before we exit the function, the program will check and make sure that that value on the stack has not been changed in any way. So if it was overwritten, it would simply like abort execution and that attack would fail. So I think there's a little example. Okay, cool. So here we are moving some value from, we move it from this FS point here into REX. We move that into RSP plus 8. And then we do some puts, we call puts. And then before we exit this program, we check to see if those values are still equal. And if they are not, we will abort the program and exit out. Nothing else will happen. So this like keeps us from doing anything dangerous in our program. And what this is going to look like here on the stack, we've got our canary that's at that 8-byte offset. And so you can see now that if you were to try and execute some sort of buffer overflow attack, you would overwrite that canary. And then even if you were able to overwrite the return address or put any other code in the buffer before this like program exited, it would check to make sure that this canary value was the same, was what it should be, the same as what it was at the beginning. So that's why it's also important to have a canary value that is like well randomized so that that can't be guessed as well, because if you could guess what the canary is, you could also just write that into your overflow, right? And I think
Kaylin, something really interesting that Dave and I kind of like discussed after the fact regarding my question last class about the global one. It sounds like Intel has Intel does have segment pointers like FS, which is a general purpose segment pointer, but there's also like other segment pointers like code segment and like one for I think the text segment. But yeah, so like that FS is like just some general register, I guess, that maybe we use to point to canaries. But those segment pointers are the closest thing to like, I think, to like the global pointer in MIPS, which I was talking about. So just in case anybody interested.
So that looks like that FS looks familiar to you, whereas I was like, you know, I don't know how this is being used exactly, but I know what it's doing. Yeah. I do want to bring up, you can, I'm just going to bring up other so I can record. Okay, I don't know where it is, never mind. What I was gonna show you too is like, when you are looking at the stack, I really wanna know what this is. I don't know if it's the beginning here. Remember we have, okay, here we go. So this is our like memory layout. And when we're talking about the executable stuff and not letting the stack be executable, all of our executable code from our program should be down in this like text area. So there's really no reason for us to allow our stack to be executable. So that's another thing that we've kind of like disabled for you guys so that you're able to exploit this program. Anybody have any questions? I think we're going to wrap up there. It looks like on Friday we'll start getting into return oriented programming, and then you'll have all the tools necessary to finish Attack Lab this weekend if you haven't already been reading ahead.
I have a question, but it's more like to invoke a discussion to help me understand.
Okay.
Can you just go back to the section in the slides where you talk about limitations on read and write?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I was looking. Yes, I think I know what you're talking about. It was not today, right? It was earlier, or are you talking about from today?
Today, yeah. So.
Okay. Cool.
Right.
So right here.
Yeah. Yeah, you're saying that you can mark areas on. So what I'm getting from this is that x86 can mark areas on the stack as read-only or writable, and then can execute anything readable. So I guess that's saying really, if you had an address on the stack that pointed to executable code, you would only want that marked as I don't understand, because if that's marked as read, then you can execute it because you can read that address.
So that's how it used to be, right? That was how it was before 8664 added this explicit execute permission. That is that was true, because they for a while only had read-only or writable, and anything you could read you could execute.
Yeah, so I guess what I'm saying is it doesn't make sense to me that you would execute something on the stack, because the stack only points to instructions in the text segment. So you would have to read from, you would have to write something into the stack that is an exploit, read it, and then execute different code in the text segment. So I don't understand marking something on the stack is non-executable. That doesn't make any sense to me. I would imagine that the way it works is you mark something on the stack as non-writable. And then you can't read something different and execute something different in the text and code segment.
So the way that this would work is far as executing things on the stack is going to be when you look at phases 2 and 3 and you start putting in actual machine bytecode into your I'm sorry, my brain is really going fast.
I don't know what you're saying.
So if you read that, if you yes, you can read addresses and stuff, and that is typically the only thing that you would read from the stack, right? Are addresses. But if somebody were to write to the stack and write in this bytecode, this executable machine code, when that gets read, it gets executed because it's code, and that's how it. Whenever the computer reads it, it just does it.
No, I get it. I totally. That's fucking fascinating.
And that's why you shouldn't have an executable stack.
Oh, that's awesome! Thank you so much. That's so cool. All right.
Okay, cool. I think unless anybody has anything else, we are probably good to wrap up. Although I'm happy to hang if anybody wants to keep asking questions.
Yeah, I think I'm
good. I can't even find my Zoom window right now. So there we go. Okay, cool. Okay. I will.
I have one question real quick.
Okay, cool.
Could you briefly explain what you said about phase 2 and 3, how in the first phase, you just send a bunch of junk code, and then you can put what you're supposed to put. But phase 2 and 3, you're supposed to put actual instructions.
So what you need to think about for phase 2 and 3 is being able to get that cookie value to a place where you want it to be. So in our case, we want it to be passed in to touch2 as a parameter. And we know from calling convention that in order for a single argument to be passed in as a parameter, it needs to get placed into RDI. So you've got to figure out how to, move something over to RDI. before you call touch two. And we've given you all the tools for that in the handout. You've got that little like dictionary of bytecode that you can use. Yeah. This is actually easy. Once you get to phase 4 and 5, you can't use, we basically make the stack not executable and you have to use code that's from other places in the program.
Sounds like that's just what we were talking about.
Yeah, exactly. And there's still a way to exploit that, but it's hard. It's harder. And the goal is to make it as hard as possible for an attacker to, you know, do anything malicious or that isn't meant to be done.
Heard that.
Okay. All right, guys. Well, I had a good time talking to you. I like this stuff. I think it's kind of fun. And yeah. I will see you either in help hours tomorrow or on Friday in class. And we'll go over some, we'll go over return-oriented program and we'll go over some phase 4 and 5 stuff too.
Okay.
All right, bye guys.